Hello, this is Atah Durakant with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, December 17th, 2024, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page, Together Decatur, Teens Learning to Own Future. Hands-on program teaches how to start and run a business. This article's by Donette Beckett, Mount Zion. It's never too early to get started on a career or at least learn about it. A few select students from Mount Zion and St. Teresa High Schools have the opportunity to learn about the business world through the Mount Zion CEO Creating Entrepreneurial Opportunities program. The program is a chance for kids to learn about entrepreneurship, said Mount Zion High School senior Jackson Byler. The students communicate with business owners about the experience of what works and what doesn't. The program uses three segments to educate the high school seniors. First, each student finds his or her own sponsorship, which will pay for the uniform and other representation. They are all local businesses that we all know and trust, said Tristan Wiry. The second focus includes hosting and organizing a holiday market with various local vendors. The proceeds from the event will go toward the third segment, developing individual businesses. 15 students were accepted into the CEO program for the current school year. Each is expected to receive approximately $400 for startup support. The students will need to finalize their business plan by January, and with the help of their sponsors and mentors, they will begin implementing the businesses. So, over Christmas break, that's your time period to think about what you want to start with, Byler said. Some of the students already know. I want to expand my mowing and landscaping business, Wiry said. With the connections that I'm building with these business owners, hopefully they can help me out. Each student will bring the business plan to the CEO board, made up of approximately 30 business owners, organization directors, and school administration. If you do a good presentation, then they'll give you all the money that you can get, said Mount Zion senior Ronnie Cole. Mount Zion High School was the first school to bring the program to Macon County 2 years ago. St. Teresa High School joined the group at the beginning of the current school year. St. Teresa senior Alyssa Wicks was one of the first students to join from the school. The experience has been positive so far. I've gotten to know different people, she said. You find a sense of community and also networking with other businesses so you can figure out what you want to do with your life. The goal for the students is to prepare for the future, they said. It is basically to teach young entrepreneurs and people that are interested in business how to do it, Cole said. If you still like it after that, you have all your connections ready for you. A lot of business owners today want to give kids a chance of getting comfortable in the environment, said Alyssa Thompson, Mount Zion senior. Many of the vendors invited to the holiday market had a connection with the students. Several students hang out at the Poke Shop Collectibles in Mount Zion, according to the shop's owner, Caleb Yancey and Jason Underwood. They told us about this, so here we are, Underwood said. As a business that frequents vendor fairs, the owners were presented with a different set of questions from students. We explained to them how the vendor fairs work, Yancey said. They asked a lot of questions about that. The program came to Mount Zion High School after a parent learned about a similar project in the Taylorville schools. But this program originates from Effingham, said Mandy Moore, who presented the program to the Mount Zion School Board 3 years ago. We are all underneath the Midland Institute for the Entrepreneurship. A board of local business and organization leaders fund the program, not the schools. The students, however, manage the program and events. This is 100% the students, said Blake Reynolds, facilitator for the students. I'm not their teacher. I'm not lecturing them. Reynolds' full-time job is a real estate broker, and I've coached basketball, he said. This is a cool way to connect with students on a business level. The students were accepted into the program through an application process. Of the 38 who applied, 15 were accepted this year. The two main things we look for are trustworthiness and hardworking, Moore said. We have a blind selection, no names. Although the program meets during a class period, they don't meet in a classroom. the students gather in business settings, such as a boardroom. It's in the business world, Reynolds said. Tyler Tate was once a student in the CEO program in Woodford County. It's about being involved, getting out there and talking to people, he said. While in the program, Tate was the co-owner of a power washing business. He said he learned to ask as many questions as possible to learn about his customers as well as the business world. As a project manager for Clean Cut in Decatur, Tate now provides assistance for the Macon County students in the program. At 19 years old, he is close to the students' ages. He is also a good example for them since he was able to use what he learned to go into the workforce. I graduated high school and went straight into it, he said. You learn a lot. And quickly. Some really nice color photos here. Large one that leads the article. Mount Zion senior Jackson Byler tests a super patch from vendor Sherry Wenskunas at the Mount Zion CEO program's holiday market at the Mount Zion Convention Center on Thursday. And Joseph Russer photos, Herald and Review. And a smaller color photo here. Really nice photo taken from down low at about tabletop level. And it reads, Mount Zion freshman Cade White and senior Alyssa Thompson wrap gifts at the Mount Zion CEO program's holiday market at the Mount Zion Convention Center on Thursday. And the wrapping paper and gifts are shown there. And both girls, young ladies, are dressed in some very nice holiday apparel. And in the top photo, Jackson Byler is dressed in the quarter zip pullover, the Mount Zion CEO program logo on the left chest. And he is laughing and smiling with vendor Sherry Wenskunas. Sidebar, hashtag Together Decatur. Do you know a person or of a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur? Well, if you do, contact Donnett Beckett at 217-421-6983 or dbeckett at herald-review.com. Local and state from the State House, state holding unspent millions, $260 million appropriated but left unallocated, agencies want to cut. This article's by Rich Miller. The Democratic legislative leaders and the governor agreed to squirrel away $260 million in lump sum appropriations to various state agencies last spring. But now some groups are figuring out a big pile of state money is just sitting there and they are trying to stake their claims. This came to light last month when the Chicago Tribune reported people advocating to replace the lost federal money for after-school programs wanted to tap into two separate $25 million lump sum legislative appropriations to the Illinois State Board of Education for, quote, grants and administrative expenses associated with after-school programs, unquote. Trouble is, the governor committed to the House Speaker and Senate President not to spend that money until all three could agree on what it would be spent on. The Tribune said it did not receive a response from the ISB, but a board spokesperson told me, at the request of the General Assembly, ISB is awaiting their direction before proceeding. The appropriation, the spokesperson said, was not tied to an existing statutory program that outlines the distribution method. ISB is working closely with leadership in the General Assembly to determine their intention for adding the new $50 million appropriation for after-school funding included in the fiscal year 25 budget, the spokesperson said. We understand the urgency surrounding after-school programming and remain committed to ensuring that these resources are allocated in a way that best serves students and families across Illinois. Also, the federal money that groups told the Tribune they actually want no longer exists, and state programs appropriation doesn't specify the $50 million should go to the 21st Century Community Learning Center grants, which is what they want it spent on. Apparently, the federal money was supposed to be used for startup grants for the past 10 years or so, but the state has allowed providers to use it as base ongoing funding. And there's a whole lot more out there. According to Governor J.B. Pritzker's spokesperson Alex Goff, there are lines included in the budget that the agencies need additional guidance from the General Assembly in order to meet the intent of the funding. Legislative sources confirmed this is the case. Aside from ISB, the agencies which need additional guidance from the legislative leaders include the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, which was lump sum appropriated $75 million for grants and contracts associated with youth employment opportunities. The Illinois Department of Public Health was appropriated $30 million for grants and administrative expenses associated with public health programs, including but not limited to awareness, outreach, and other programs to improve health outcomes. The Illinois Community College Board was also appropriated $30 million for grants and administrative expenses associated with workforce development programs. So far, I'm told none of those agencies and boards have set up any mechanism to distribute the money. Only the Illinois Department of Human Services has sent out a notice of funding availability for its $75 million appropriation for grants and administrative expenses associated with youth employment programs, but no decisions have yet been made. What's going on here? Well, legislative leaders had a ton of pressure from their members for more spending, but there simply wasn't enough money to pay for it all. So they created these lump sums in order to cram more pressure into less money. The leaders could have specified exactly how the money was to be spent, but then the leaders would have committed to spending way more than the available revenues allowed. Instead, by doing it this way, the leaders could tell individual members that their pet projects were funded, even though they technically aren't until the leaders decide what, if anything, to do with the lump sum cash. The governor and the ISBE have the power to spend the money now, but these vague lump sums were part of the final budget deal, which is deemed almost a sacred covenant. Once a governor or a legislative leader breaks a budget deal, a lot of trust is lost, and future deals become that much harder to make. But the same thing happened last year when legislators demanded a ton of spending, even though there wasn't enough money to pay for it. The difference this year is the state is looking at a large budget deficit next fiscal year, so things will need to change. At the very least, whatever is funded this year might not be continued next year. At most, some money might not be spent at all to help patch the upcoming hole. Man who shot at car gets probation. Decatur. Command D. Brown, the Decatur gunman who couldn't have chosen a worse moment to open fire, has been sentenced to 24 months probation. Brown, 24, had pulled out a handgun and pumped three bullets into a passing car around 5:46 a.m. June 22nd. The shooting on North Jasper Street hit and wounded a 36-year-old male victim in the left shoulder, and the whole incident was witnessed by Detective Sean Bowser with the Decatur Police Department. Bowser had been dispatched to the area of East Main and North Illinois Streets earlier because of 911 calls about a large group of people jumping a lone victim. One of the assailants was described as being armed with a gun. A sworn affidavit filed by Officer Tanner Brummett said Bowser was standing about 325 feet away when he saw an Audi car make a turn near to a man later identified as Brown who stood watching on a street corner. Officer Bowser observed the male fire 3 to 5 gunshots at the passenger side of the Audi, Brummett said. Bowser rushed to the aid of the wounded victim, who was soon taken to the hospital. The detective noted 3 bullet holes in the car. Brown had promptly fled but was identified by several witnesses and tracked down and arrested July 13th. He had been pleading not guilty to charges of aggravated battery with a firearm. 2 counts alleging the aggravated discharge of a gun and 1 charge of being a felon in possession of a weapon. Brown's trial on those charges was due to begin Monday, but he appeared December 13th in Macon County Circuit Court and took a plea deal negotiated by defense attorney Susan Moorhead. This saw him admit to a new charge of the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon, a Class 4 felony. Judge Jeffrey Geisler then agreed to dismiss all of the original charges. The police affidavit about the shooting said it arose from an earlier fight involving the victim and Brown. The defendant had pulled a gun during that confrontation and fired it into the air just before police arrived and a large crowd had scattered, including the victim. But witnesses told police the victim's girlfriend's cell phone had been lost at the time and a tracking app had pinged it to the fight location. When the victim returned with his girlfriend, a fight had broken out again and Brown had opened fire as the couple were trying to drive away. Passing sentence, Geisler also ordered Brown to undergo a substance abuse evaluation while on probation and complete any recommended treatment within 18 months. Brown, who had been held in the Macon County Jail since his arrest, was released from custody after the sentencing hearing. Man accused of attempted murder, Rob Stroud, Charleston. Pretrial release has been denied for an 18-year-old Mattoon man charged with attempted murder for an altercation after which the victim required emergency brain surgery. Defendant Quentin Garcia also had been charged with aggravated battery and mob action for the altercation last week in the 1200 block of Edgar Avenue in Mattoon, during which he allegedly kicked the victim in the head while he was on the ground. Garcia was arrested on December 10th by the Mattoon Police Department and had remained in the custody of the jail since then following the Coles County State's Attorney's Office filing the felony charges against him. Coles County Public Defender Dwayne Dieters petitioned for pretrial release for Garcia at a status hearing Monday morning. The requested release would have included electronic monitoring for Garcia, no contact provisions, and other conditions. Dieters contended that his client was not the initial aggressor because the victim had traveled from outside of Coles County to Mattoon residence where Garcia was located to confront him. He acted in self-defense, Dieters said. In addition, Dieters argued that the battery of the victim's head with a baseball bat during the altercation is alleged to have been committed by a juvenile defendant who was arrested in this case. The Mattoon Police Department reported in a news release that the arrests occurred after it was notified early December 10th of an individual receiving treatment at a local hospital for injuries sustained from a physical altercation. It was later discovered through a family member that the victim sustained head injuries that required emergency brain surgery, the news release stated. Circuit Judge Brian Bowser said he is aware that police investigators have reported that both Garcia and the victim are part of two different groups of people who have a, quote, long-standing feud, unquote. Bauer said the request for pretrial release with conditions for Garcia would not mitigate the dangers cited by investigators. The court subsequently denied request and found that the need for continued detention at the jail had been met. Assistant State's Attorney Chase Rich represented the prosecution at Monday's status hearing. Garcia's next court appearance is preliminary hearing on January 6th. Information on the status of the juvenile defendant's case was not available Monday morning. The police department has reported that the juvenile was transported to the Vermilion County Juvenile Center for detention. On A3, local and state agriculture, kind of a neat article here. Horseradish rooted in Illinois, southwest of state, major growing area for pungent plant. This article's by Rhiannon Branch, Farm Week, Glen Carbon. All grain farmers have something to occupy their time in the winter, but for Craig and Kenny Engling, the off-season is even busier as they harvest horseradish. I started farming corn, soybeans, and wheat back in the early 80s, and the farm economy was just horrible, said Craig Engling. My dad had an in on the horseradish business, and that's how I got my start in 1985. Now C&K Horseradish in Glen Carbon grows about 170 acres of the specialty crop in one of the highest production areas of the country. We have very rich, deep topsoil in the Madison, St. Clair, and Monroe County area, Craig Engling said. I think around 60% of the horseradish world supply comes out of here. His son Kenny said they began planting in March as soon as the ground is soft enough to work, using roots from the previous season's crop. Generally, after 9 to 10 months, it's starting to hit its peak yield, and that is the harvest window we are trying to meet for quality and tonnage, Kenny said. The horseradish can be harvested at any time of year, but winter is ideal. Everything about horseradish is hot, from the flavor to holding heat, Kenny said, so if you're harvesting in hot months, you really have to manage it to keep from spoiling. And it's a labor-intensive process. Once it comes out of the field, every plant has to be gone through by hand, Kenny said. They have to be trimmed, sorted by different grades, and packaged accordingly. It then gets housed in a cold storage facility kept at 28 degrees before being sold to customers across the country in the wholesale market. The process begins again in March when harvest and planting often overlap. A lot of times, it's a 13-month season, Kenny said. Every year is different. There were some years we started harvest as early as September, and there have been years where we've been running as late as June. The Englings cited labor as the biggest challenge in the horseradish industry. They have been fortunate with one other full-time employee and a dozen local seasonal workers who return annually, but they are looking into more automated field harvesting equipment so their employees can spend more time sorting. As for the growing season, Kenny said, pest pressure was high this year for unknown reasons, and drought made the crop look poor early on, but late fall rains helped the crop finish strong. The roots really start putting their weight on going into the fall. And so a wetter fall is where you start getting your bigger yields, Kenny said, noting that yields are determined by the pound. Winter weather can also affect the crop. Heavy snow is a double-edged sword as it would slow down harvest but potentially increase yields. Those roots are deep into the ground, Craig Engling said. If they're under the frost and can keep growing, I've seen 20% yield increase over wintertime. Looking forward, Kenny Engling said they have been working to increase production to fill demand. But it is a defined market, so you have to have the market share, he said. It's all marketed a year in advance, so you have to know what you can and can't do and be able to market towards that target. As he nears retirement, Craig said he's enjoyed watching the next generation take charge. It's kind of a neat thing watching the changes, the new ambition, and the new ideas come to life, the elder Engling concluded. And there's a small color photo here at the production sorting line, and the caption reads, employees at C&K Horseradish chop and sort horseradish roots by hand and set them on a conveyor belt system to be packaged according to grade. Some roots are even kept to plant for next year's crop. So it's taken from behind all the people working, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, their backs turned to us, overturned, looks like dark gray recycling tubs, stacked one face down, two rotated 90 degrees, and then one on top facing up. And we don't see the conveyor, but we see on the far left of the picture a green chute, and it looks like that's where they are sorted, and then they come out into a bin. And the photo credit goes to Rhiannon Branch Farm Week. Move on to Nation and World on A6. Fed likely to slow rate cuts, Christopher Rugeber, Associated Press, Washington. Americans hoping for lower borrowing costs for homes, credit cards, and cars may be disappointed after this week's Federal Reserve meeting. The Fed's policymakers are likely to signal fewer interest rate cuts next year than were previously expected. The officials are set to reduce their benchmark rate, which affects many consumer and business loans, by a quarter point to about 4.3% when their meeting ends Wednesday. At that level, the rate would be a full point below the four-decade high it reached in July of 2023. The policymakers kept their key rate at its peak for more than a year to try to quell inflation until slashing the rate by a half point in September and a quarter point last month. The problem is that while inflation dropped far below its peak of 9.1% in mid-2022, it remains stubbornly above the Fed's 2% target. As a result, the Fed, led by Chair Jerome Powell, is expected Wednesday to signal a shift to a more gradual approach to rate cuts in 2025. Economists say that after cutting rates for three straight meetings, the central bank will likely do so at every other gathering, or possibly even less often than that. We are on the cusp of a transition to them not cutting every meeting, said David Wilcox, a former senior Fed official who is an economist with Bloomberg Economics and the Peterson Institute for International Economics. They're going to slow the tempo of cuts. The economy fared better than officials expected it would as recently as September, and inflation pressures proved more persistent. The presidential election added a wild card too. President-elect Donald Trump promises to enact policies from much higher taxes on imports to mass deportations of people living illegally in the United States that most economists say threaten to accelerate inflation. Growth is definitely stronger than we thought, and inflation is coming in a little higher, Powell said recently. So the good news is we can afford to be a little more cautious as the Fed's officials seek to lower rates to what they consider a neutral level, one that neither spurs nor restricts growth. On Wednesday, policymakers will also issue their quarterly projections for growth, inflation, unemployment, and their benchmark interest rate over the next 3 years. In September, they collectively envision that they'd cut rates four times next year. Economists now expect just two or three Fed rate cuts in 2025. Wall Street traders foresee even fewer, just two cuts, according to futures prices. Fewer rate cuts by the Fed would mean that households and businesses would continue to face loan rates, notably for home mortgages, that would far exceed their levels before the inflation surged more than 3 years ago. Some economists question whether the Fed even needs to cut this week. Inflation, excluding volatile food and energy costs, has been stuck at an annual rate of about 2.8% since March. A year ago, the policymakers forecast that a figure would have fallen to 2.4% by now, and that they'd have cut their key rate by 0.75 point. Instead, inflation became stuck at a higher level, yet the Fed lowered its benchmark rate by a full point. Fed officials, including Powell, say they still foresee inflation heading lower, however slowly, while their key rate is still high enough to restrain growth. As a result, reducing rates this week is more akin to letting up on a brake than stepping on an accelerator. Interesting. Real quick on the life section, Merry Music ringing the festivities with 11 new albums. The Philly Specials, a Philly special Christmas party. Vince Gill and Amy Grant, When I Think of Christmas. Toby Keith, Christmas to Christmas. Jennifer Hudson, The Gift of Love. The Carpenters, Christmas Once More. Clay Aiken, Christmas Bells Are Ringing. Ben Folds, Slayer. The Temptations, Give Love at Christmas. Jimmy Fallon, Holiday Seasoning. Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, Ella and Louis Wish You a Swinging Holiday. Little Big Town, The Christmas Record. And we'll end today's first half hour on the weather page, B8, with the Decatur 4-day forecast. Today, mostly cloudy, wind south-southwest 4 to 8 miles per hour, high of 50. Tonight, cloudy with a shower, wind east 4 to 8 miles per hour, low of 35. Wednesday, mostly sunny and cooler, wind northwest 8 to 16 miles per hour, high of 40 and low of 26. Thursday, sunshine and a few clouds, wind south 7 to 14 miles per hour, high of 40 and low of 27. Friday, colder with flurries, wind north 10 to 20 miles per hour, high of 33 and low of 20. Regional outlook, mostly cloudy today. Expect 2 to 4 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 70%. And poor drying conditions. A shower tonight, chance of precipitation 80% with average humidity 80%. And the Skywatch sunrise 7:11 a.m. set 4:32 p.m. Moonrise 6:55 p.m. set 9:35 a.m. Last quarter moon December 22nd, new moon December 30th, first quarter moon January 6th, and full moon January 13th. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, December 17th, 2024. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.